Om. It is a joy and a blessing to be with you all for study of Bhagavad Gita. And each session, I begin by sharing teachings that were from Yogacharya O'Brien, from her lessons to us a couple of years ago. And then I share a few insights, and then we have time for this dialogue. And the teachings from Yogacharya that I'll share today were recorded on March 22nd, 2023, initially. Let's begin with a short prayer. Let your heart and your mind open to the infinite source of wisdom. We acknowledge that truth of all truths, love of all loves, life of all life. And we acknowledge that as the source and substance of all that is. We offer our pranams, our respect to the gurus in this tradition of Kriya Yoga, who have shared the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita in their own way through the generations. Mavatar Babaji, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Teshwar, Paramahansa Yogananda, Roy Eugene Davis, and our beloved Umaji, Yogacharya O'Brien. We open ourselves to our innate wisdom, that these teachings be revealed from within, and that they offer a spiritual power of steadiness and stillness. Om, peace, peace, peace. We're continuing to reflect on Lord Krishna's response to Arjuna's question in chapter 2 of the Gita. What does it look like when a person is enlightened or has steadfast wisdom? What does that look like in the world? What is that experience? How is that consciousness reflected in the way that person interacts in the world? So we understand this question to be our question, something like, okay, I'm on the spiritual path. How is that going to look? How is it going to change me? How is it going to affect my relationships in life and so on? So really, the question we're asking is, are enlightenment and worldly existence compatible? Do we have to leave our situations in the world to live an awakened life? And the Lord has already told Arjuna, no, no, you're in the world. Do your duty in the world, but do it as an awakened person. So, what we learn is that enlightenment and worldly mindedness are not compatible. It's the worldly mindedness that has to go. This chapter is about being one with steadfast wisdom. Steadfast meaning not having insight about awakened living and then losing it, but having steadfast wisdom, dependable wisdom. Once we're on the spiritual path, we start to see things more clearly and we experience awakened discernment and intuition. And we want to know how that can stay with us as we engage in this world. So we come to a class or a retreat or satsang, and we're very inspired. We see clearly. We know how we want to be, and we know what we should do. Then we go back into our routines of life, and somehow all of that just goes out the window. This chapter is about knowing what we should do and doing it. Not losing sight of the inspiration and the motivation that we experience. Instead of momentary insights followed by intermittent disappointment in our ability to carry it through, we develop a steadfast wisdom. And I think that's what we all want. That's one of the reasons this chapter is so important for us. So today we're going to look at verses 58 and 59 of chapter 2. But we're going to start by circling back to verses 55 and 57 about purifying the mental field and the necessity for renunciation of attachment and desire, along with superconscious meditation, samadhi. The two are necessary. Otherwise, if desires fill the mind, then our mind becomes like a workshop of ego-based identity, and our discernment is clouded. Yogacharya said when she was thinking about this lesson, she had this visual of Santa's workshop with all the little elves producing things. And that's why it's so important for us to get a handle on the tendency to increase desires in order to prop up the ego. So we want to learn how to reduce desires and disentangle the ego-based identity so we can be guided by the soul instead of being tossed about by the changes in circumstances. When that happens, we lose contact with ourself and we become worldly minded. So the key for this change is in verse 55 of chapter 2, which is why I want to underscore it, because it describes the two necessary ingredients that make it possible for us to let go of restless desires. That verse says, when a person completely casts off all desires of the mind and is satisfied in the self by the self, then that one is said to be of steady wisdom. It's possible then to let go of restless desire in the mind because we're already satisfied. That's the key, because we are satisfied in the self by the self. So to try to just cut off desires by itself is not going to work. It needs to have that component of being satisfied. We understand that this is not a negative proposition for a life of denial, like, okay, I'm not going to have this, I'm not going to have that, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. It's not a sort of austerity that rejects life. Instead, the Gita's pointing out that it's when we are established in steady wisdom, we've learned how to abide in the fullness of the self. We've learned how to live in the soul. That's when the experience of fullness or bliss or joy comes, because it is inherent to our very being. We don't have to keep looking for it externally. We're not looking for something to complete us because we are already complete. Letting go of restless desires that cloud the mind is not denying ourself, it's embracing ourself. It's letting go of what can be problematic. And it's also letting go of that which we know through our awakened discernment, that which we know is not ultimately fulfilling. So we want to get off that treadmill. And that is what this is teaching us. It's telling us we can do this through discernment. We realize that the world of creative objects is ultimately unsatisfying because they are subject to change. That's a basic observation we can make. They cannot provide us with unconditional happiness that we seek because all manifest things are conditional. That's their nature. They're changeable. They're mutable. They're limited by their very nature. So our wisdom becomes stabilized through discernment about the transitory nature of things. They start to lose their charm for us. So it's not that we don't enjoy life, but we see that the actual source of our unconditional happiness is the divine. And the other part that we see in verse 55 is that we have the completely fulfilling experience of our innate wholeness. Those two have to work together for this method to work for us. It's just like a healthy person who's eaten a meal and is full is not going to want something else to eat. One who's established in the innate experience of wholeness is not tossed about in life by wanting something else. There's a freedom that comes from not always wanting. One is satisfied in the self by the self. Then the next two verses describe how abiding in this fullness brings about equanimity in the face of the pairs of opposites that are inherent to creation. It's just the way life is. Yogacharya writes, and I will echo this for myself, many of you who know me know I am a basketball fan. And she said at the time that this was recorded, my team, the Warriors, were not doing well. So little sidebar, last night we could agree with this. Warriors not doing well. However, we will not affirm that for this season. So this was recorded a couple of years ago. The Warriors a couple of years ago were not doing well. They were at the top for such a long time. We were really used to them being at the top. But at that time, they were close to the bottom. But that's the way life is. That's the pairs of opposites. We learn about that and then how this fullness can give us equanimity in the face of those kinds of changes that we encounter in life. Verse 56 says, one whose mind is not agitated in misfortune. Let's just stop right there for a sidebar. Okay, so I'm sorry if I'm ruining this for any of you who have not yet watched the recording of the Warriors game. If you haven't seen it yet, don't watch it. And if you have, you know your mind may have been agitated by misfortune last night. So this verse says, one whose mind is not agitated in misfortune, whose desire for pleasure has disappeared, whose passion, fear, and anger have departed, and whose meditation is steady, is said to be a sage. Now it's interesting. It doesn't say that pleasure has to disappear from your life. It says the desire for it That's an important understanding, isn't it? One who is without attachment on all sides, encountering this or that, pleasant or unpleasant, your team is winning, your team is losing, you're winning, you're losing, neither rejoicing nor disliking, that person's wisdom stands firm. Sometimes people say they're not interested in this spiritually conscious approach to life because it sounds boring to be even-minded. And you may have felt that way yourself at some point, or you may have had a conversation with someone who said, "Nope, not signing up for that. To let go of passionate desire? I don't want to let go of my passionate desire. And I don't want to let go of my anger. It all seems important to me," they would say. So they imagine it to be some numbness or lack of aliveness. They want to be free to have and to express those passions. But once we begin to awaken spiritually, we discern that acting on impulses is not a way of freedom, nor is it joy. A person, however, has to have enough experience of life, enough insight about life, enough maturity, along with a rising innate urge for soul freedom to awaken, to be drawn to the path. So you might recognize that in yourself, that difference that comes in the understanding of what freedom is. The freedom that you wanted at an immature state in your life, and the freedom that you want as you begin to progress on the spiritual path, to be ready for it and to commit to it, and to know clearly what it is offering, because what the teachings offer is indeed freedom and clarity and joy. It indicates how we can cooperate with the infinite, how we can live an inspired life, a soul-guided life, how we can cooperate with the powers of nature and the presence of divine grace. But doing that, actually doing that, requires insight, commitment, and self-discipline. Otherwise, we continue to be tossed about by circumstances and the patterns in our own mind. So these verses are about purifying the mind. The mind colors our experience of life. We can observe that. Not everybody experiences the same thing in the same way. Why is that? Because the mind has been colored differently. If my team is losing and I don't like that, but the team that's winning against my team and their fans are really happy about that, it's the mind that colors the experience. So when we cling to desires, the mental field becomes the ego's workshop of selfish drives that bring suffering to ourselves and to others. Many of you know that we broadcast daily inspiration from the center every day. And those who subscribe to that, they get a little message in their inbox, or it's here on the chalkboard in the meditation garden. And the inspiration on March 21st, 2023, the day before Yogacharya recorded this, said, "The mind is purified through meditation and dispassion. By being non-reactive to changes and non-attached to outcomes, with a pure mind, love can prevail." So think of it like that. Think of this disciplined path like that. Being free to love, free to live in love by love, because that is what you are. And there's a beautiful promise of that freedom. Then we turn to verse 58, where it gets more practical. We want to clarify the mental field, but what about those senses that are running towards their objects? It's like we are out for a walk and the senses are already running into the bakery shop. What do we do with them? How do we manage that? Well, verse 58 of chapter 2 says, when, like a tortoise that withdraws its limbs on all sides, a person withdraws their senses from sense objects, then their wisdom becomes steady. When, like a tortoise that withdraws its limbs on all sides, a person withdraws their senses from sense objects, then their wisdom becomes steady. So you can see why meditation is the practice ground for being in the world and having the ability to draw our attention and awareness away from the wandering paths of sensory input. The five doorways of sensory experience are seeing, tasting, hearing, touching, smelling, connected to form, flavor, sound, texture, and odor. So this verse highlights two skills that are pratyahara, which we recognize from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Pratyahara is the ability to control the senses by interiorizing our attention and awareness, drawing it away from sensory input. As Yogacharya's teacher, Roy Eugene Davis, would say, it is the reversing the searchlight of our attention. And Paramahansa G called it disconnecting the sense telephones, just unplugging from the energy that's going outward and turning it around. It's the fifth of the eight limbs of Raja Yoga and the essential bridge between pranayama, the regulation of breath, and dharana, or concentration, as we prepare to meditate. These two skills that are referenced here are one, to be able to draw our attention and our awareness away from sensory input to direct it within, to experience samadhi or superconscious meditation. It's the skill of meditation, being able to withdraw our attention from the senses back through the mind and then beyond the mind. That's pratyahara. So we have the example of drawing the limbs within to remove the mind from sources of distraction and allow our attention to flow toward our chosen point of concentration. That's the first skill that this verse is highlighting. And then the second skill is our ability to use our discernment to withdraw our attention and awareness away from sensory input that is not useful for our purpose. So, here the image of the tortoise is a really good one. It has the capacity to move through the world, gathering sensory perceptions and experiences, and the ability to withdraw into its shell at the sign of a threat. So, using our discernment, we can use the skill of pratyahara, the withdrawal of our attention from sensory input that is not conducive to our higher purpose or well-being. We just disconnect from it. Or, in modern terminology, we just don't go there. We withdraw our attention, our prana, our life force. Like the tortoise, we protect our energy. As yogis, we protect our energy, our body, our mind. So pratyahara is like a doorway to the self, moving attention from the outer world to the inner. Yogacharya says when she spoke in an earlier session about Arjuna's questions, what does the person of steadfast wisdom look like in meditation? What do they look like in the world? How do they speak? How do they sit? How do they move about? She talked about the blessing of the time she had with her guru, Roy Eugene Davis, and how she could witness that he lived so purposefully. He was a master of his prana, his energy. He didn't waste his prana. He didn't waste his energy, his focus on things that were not useful to his purpose, to his dharma. He didn't engage in conversation that was frivolous. And it wasn't that he wasn't joyful and didn't have fun. It was that he didn't get sidetracked. That's really what this verse is about for us. It's about intentional living as yogis, not allowing ourselves to get sidetracked, not allowing the mind to wander down these sensory avenues, but being a master of our energy. Dr. David Frawley wrote, "Control of the senses is the most important form of pratyahara. Although this is not something that we like to hear about in our mass media-oriented culture, the problem is that the senses, like untrained children, have their own will, which is largely instinctual by nature. They tell the mind what to do. And if we don't discipline them, they dominate us with their endless demands. We're so accustomed to the ongoing sensory activity that we don't know how to keep our minds quiet." Little sidebar in the middle of Dr. Frawley's note. It sounds like what it's like when we get a puppy, doesn't it? They have all their demands while they're untrained. And they're instinctual in nature. If you're out for a walk, even if they're on a leash and they see a bird take off, they're going for it. And they're pulling you along until they're trained. They dominate us with their endless demands. He goes on, "We're so accustomed to ongoing sensory activity that we don't know how to keep our minds quiet. We have become hostages of the world of senses and its allurements. We're running after what is appealing to the senses and forget about the higher goals of life. For this reason, pratyahara is probably the most important limb of yoga for people today." And then Yogacharya says there are many yogic practices for pratyahara. One of the simplest is just withdrawing, just removing ourselves from sensory overload or bombardment. Unplug, remove yourself from distraction, turn off the television, turn off the computer, turn away from outer stimulation. And this process is important to understand. It harkens back to verse 55. It's not just about suppressing through willpower. You probably know that doesn't work. Just using our will to make a change is rarely successful in the long run. Yogacharya's guru, in his commentary on the Gita, wrote, "The wise person does not suppress physical and mental urges. Instead, awareness is withdrawn from things and circumstances which might otherwise tempt the senses or energize desire." So if we know something is problematic for us, we don't go there. We take it out of our environment, or we don't go into that environment. We start withdrawing our attention and our vital force from that. Then he says, an easy first step of accomplishment is to be soul-centered, dispassionate, and disinterested. So if you're having trouble letting go of something, turn your attention to something more worthwhile and let the lesser fall away. Discernment can enable us to determine what the unfortunate outcome of unreasoned behavior may be. In contrast to what the outcome would be when wisdom is allowed to govern our behavior, we use our discernment by asking ourselves questions like, what is walking down that road going to do for me? What is doing that thing going to do for me? What has it been doing for me? And then Roy G. continues and writes, it's easier to regulate sensory inclinations and desires when our aspiration to spiritual growth determines our sense of purpose in life. That's what the fuel for pratyahara is. It's being connected to our higher purpose. Why? We don't want to just be tossed about by desire. I mean, not only is it painful, and we know we can't find happiness there, but it also interferes with our ability to fulfill our dharma, to fulfill our life purpose. Roy says, regular practice of contemplative meditation turns soul forces inward to the source of being. It neutralizes prana flow, calms the mind, and produces a condition of mental, emotional, and physiological balance, which allows soul awareness to remain constant. So, a little sidebar. Do we all want that right now in our lives with everything going on in the world? The regular practice of contemplative meditation turns soul forces inward to the source of being, neutralizes prana flow, balances our energy, calms the mind, and produces a condition of mental, emotional and physiological balance, which allows soul awareness to remain constant. So we're back again to renunciation combined with super conscious meditation. That's the winning combination. And then verse 59 says, the objects of the senses turn away from one who abstains from them. It says, but the taste, meaning the memory and desire, the taste remains. Even this turns away when supreme reality is apprehended. When we decide we're not going to do something, we have so much we can accomplish with willpower and detachment. But we learn through our study of this philosophy that there are imprints of those desires in the mental field. And given the right conditions, those desires will rise once again until they have been nullified through superconscious meditation and through realization of the truth of our being. Then those desires have no more home here because they are rooted in the ego self, in the sense of separate identity. Once we're freed from that, these imprints in the mind go along with it. commentaries in this verse, chapter 259, usually indicate that abstinence, turning away from or renouncing sensory desire, may temporarily improve them, but is not a permanent solution. Why? Because the longing, the desire for sense experience, is in the mind. It is not in the senses. It's in the mind. The desire is an imprint in the mental field. So while we may succeed at resisting or turning away from sensory desires, at some point that desire will arise again in the mind. It's only when the mental field has been purified through samadhi, the realization of our true self, that those desires are removed. They're rooted out. It's said in the scriptures that they're burnt. They're burnt like a seed that cannot sprout anymore. When we awaken to our fullness, our wholeness, then the mental field no longer supports those remnants of desire. This is why any good program to help us get through negative habits or addictions is combined with a spiritual program. Because it's not just at the level of abstinence. One has to have the fullness that comes from self-knowing, from a spiritual connection to truly transform. Do you ever have an experience that you were attached to something, attracted to it, or even perhaps addicted to? And it's something you renounced and then you truly let go of. What happened? If we look, if we have this life experience, we can notice in that situation that was once in our life, in our environment, and in our field of awareness, it begins to fade away. And after a time, it isn't in our field anymore. We don't have that desire. It's not ours. We're not running into it. We're not calling it forth. It's a very interesting process, isn't it? We no longer even encounter it, or rarely so. And this is a basic principle of mind. What we hold in our mind and our consciousness, we draw to us. It comes into our mental field from our mind. In writing in his commentary on the Gita, Roy Eugene Davis wrote, "The subjective causative law or principle of correspondences determines that our states of consciousness and mental states attract circumstances which conform to them." Sidebar, I'll make cliff notes of the cliff notes. What is in our mind comes to us. Yogacharya says we tend to attract that which we are agreeable to experiencing, or what we desire and can accept. When we have no agreements, feelings, or thoughts about a thing, experience, or circumstances, these objects of the senses are no longer attracted by us. When we let go of agreements, of feelings, of thoughts about a thing, experience, or circumstances, these objects of senses are no longer attracted by us. And they seem to turn away because we're not pulling them in. So we might wonder why then sometimes they show up again. Whoa, I thought I let that go. Now here it is again. What is that doing here? How can I truly let that go? Well, that's the next lesson. Next lesson, we'll explore how traces of desire can be removed from the mental field. Wow. Once again, it's like the part where Umaji says, someone who's healthy has eaten, is no longer hungry, doesn't go after anything else. So we have been filled, but I will try to add extra something to the dessert. You know, I've been addressing how to stay anchored in the self, the way of a stable mind in a changing world. And in these times of global uncertainty and inner unrest, we seek not just temporary calm, but enduring stillness. And this arises from spiritual realization. So chapter 2, verses 57 and 58 of the Gita offer us clear instruction on how to live with wisdom, clarity, and peace amidst the world's turmoil. Verse 57 says, one who is without attachment, neither rejoicing when good things happen nor hating when bad things happen, is firmly established in wisdom. And verse 58 continues in this theme. When one withdraws completely the senses from objects of the senses, as a tortoise draws in its limbs, this one's wisdom is steady. This verse describes stitta prajna, the person of steady wisdom, unshaken by gain or loss, pleasure or pain. And we know this is not indifference, but it's a profound equanimity that's born from knowing the truth of who and what we are. And in Kriya Yoga, we understand that such a steadiness is cultivated through deep inner discipline, meditation, and discernment. Umaji Yogacharya O'Brien writes, the yogi lives in the world without being of the world, acting selflessly while remaining inwardly detached. So this inner detachment is not escape. It is engagement without entanglement. We can engage without being tied in knots around what we're engaging with. So in a chaotic world filled with constant stimulation, information overload, emotional upheaval, the wisdom of these verses teaches us to withdraw, not to retreat, although you should come on the retreat, but not to retreat from what's happening in the world, but to return to the self. Roy Eugene Davis reminds us, the purpose of meditation practice is to detach our attention from external and mental influences and become aware of our essence of being. Through the practices of Kriya, particularly superconscious meditation, we, like the tortoise, draw our senses inward. Like this tortoise, we retract our attention from the turbulence of the world, and we settle it into the silent sanctuary within. This does not mean that we ignore the suffering around us. Rather, we respond from a place of spiritual clarity rather than reactionary chaos. We don't get sucked into it. Paramahansa Yogananda taught, you know this quote, it's a beautiful one. You must not let your life run in the ordinary way. Do something that nobody else has done, something that will dazzle the world. Show that God's creative principle works in you. You know, if you're going to a march, bring a sign that will dazzle the world, that shows God's creative principle works within you. So, to live in this creative, inspired way, we must root ourselves in divine consciousness. Verses 57 and 58 give us both the diagnosis and the prescription. The condition of attachment leads to suffering, and the remedy is self mastery through inward withdrawal and steady wisdom. Not changing, not fluctuating. Baba Hari Das echoed this practice-oriented wisdom. Don't react, act. Action from a calm mind is the most effective. Don't react, act. That'd be a nice sign. The citta prajna does not suppress emotions. They arise and pass like waves on the surface of a deep ocean, but they no longer pull the wise one into identification with the wave or reactivity. This is the fruit of abhyasa, spiritual practice, and vairagya, non-attachment, of course, which are central tenets of Kriya Yoga. Eknath Eswaran wrote, "Meditation is not evasion. It is a serene encounter with reality." So, in our world today, filled with crisis, rapid change, polarization, the call these verses send are radical. Anchor yourself in the changeless self. Anchor yourself. Return again and again to the inner center where peace is not dependent on circumstances. I was out for a hike the other day, and I came upon, I choose these hikes. I always have a goal to choose a hike where I can be on a dirt path where there aren't bicycles flying by and where there aren't that many people, because I like to just use it as a time to turn within. And I came upon a group of women hikers who look about like me, and I never talked to people, and I stopped and said hello, these three women. And I said, "Oh, seasoned hikers like myself." They said, "Oh, I like that, seasoned." And I just stopped for a minute, said hello, had a, you know, nice, basically, we were all taking a break from the hills. They were going one way, I was going the other. Then I continue on. I come upon this other woman, another seasoned hiker, and she was hiking alone, and I stopped and I just said hello. You know, we talked about the beautiful flowers and all of that. And she looked me in the eye, said, "Oh, we're both seasoned hikers." She said, "Oh, honey, you're nowhere near me." And I told her my age, and she said, "I'm 80." I mean, she looked like she was 70, 72 maybe. And she said, "I've been going hiking every day since January 20th. And every day I'd find several trees to touch." And she wasn't a, you know, pardon me, but a tree hugger type person. I find trees to touch because I need to find a way to anchor myself in something that's bigger than all the chaos in the world. And I told her about the retreat that's coming up and how it's really a focus on that. It's really focused on how do we settle our energy in a way that supports us to be in the world, but not of it. And, I wasn't trying to get her to come. We were just talking. And I asked her how she'd been feeling about all the chaos in the world. It broke my heart. She looked me right in the eye and said, depressed and angry. So clearly. And I thought, oh, that's true, right? But most of us won't say we feel angry. But it's true. It is what is under frustration, is anger. So, and she said, so much has been going on in our nation and our world. The other day, I just threw my arms up and said, what's the sense of all of it? And I just said, well, keep walking and touching trees. So it was heartbreaking to have someone that clear say that. And I continued on my hike. And then I came upon the three women again. As I was going up the hill, they were coming down. And we stopped and chatted again. And I told them about meeting the other woman. I told them about the retreat. They said, where are you leading a retreat? I said, Center for Spiritual Enlightenment. And one of them said, oh, I know about that place. I used to live very near there. And another one said, yeah, I know about Ellen, Yogacharya O'Brien, and she's taking a year away, right? I said, indeed she is. And she said, this woman said, they were probably in their late 70s and 80s also. This one lady said, well, who is it I would be dealing with if it was financial things going on at the center, like donations? I said, probably me. I told her my name and she took her glasses off and told me her name. And it's someone who I have been dealing with in a very positive way with her generosity in support of the ministry for the last 2 years. She doesn't even come to CSE. So the universe conspires to support us and put things in front of us to lift us up. When we clear desires from the mental field, I let go of the desire to having to be completely alone, not talk to anyone. And the universe said, hey, look at all this inspiration. I'm even going to put these people in front of you to prove to you that I'm in charge by telling you that they've never been to the center, but they know all about you and all about it. So, I don't know. What do we say? It works if you work it. Meditation and non-attachment. And we can use an affirmation or a mantra if we find ourselves getting caught in the waves of the world. You know, Uma has this nice affirmation centered in the self. I remain calm, clear, and connected. Centered in the self, I remain calm, clear, and connected. You know, if you're walking, you could just inhale with the step and say inwardly centered, exhale, connected. Pick a couple of words that work for you. Or I am calm. I am the calm center of life's storm. I like hers. So let us withdraw like the tortoise, not to hide, but to reestablish experience of your connection with your inner self, your highest source. Then return to the world, not as one who's being swept along, but as one who steadies the path for others. If you're someone who touches trees, stay on the path, touch the trees, steady it. for others. This is the path of a Kriya Yogi. And this is the promise of inner freedom. And you can do it, as Roy would say. You can do it in this lifetime. Om. That was a little extra, but I really wanted to share the story about the ladies on the trail. It was so inspiring to me. So I'm happy to hear from some of you, and wonderful to see you all. See you both there in Santa Rosa together. How wonderful. Good morning. That was some inspiring teaching from Uma, huh? Calm, connected. You know, it's okay to yell at the television during the basketball game. That's all right. That's just being engaged, but don't give your peace away for the rest of the night and the rest of your life. It's a game. It's okay. It's okay to be depressed and angry for a moment about the situation around us, to feel it. It's okay. It's real in the sense of this realm of duality. But don't let it carry you away. It's not unspiritual to feel it, right? Just don't let it carry you away. Okay, thoughts from you. I'm waiting for you. I'm talking while I'm waiting. Sakshi, can you unmute yourself?
It won't let me.
Yes, it did.
Oh, good. Okay. I was at a satsang last night, and one of the persons was talking about, she was in India, up in the Himalayas. And she watched a bus of people. The bus fell over the side of the road and rolled down. She's like, oh my goodness. But nobody got hurt. And so the people got out of the bus, walked back up the road, and got into another bus. And I thought, wow, they were unshook. They just got up and continued on. And I thought that was remarkable. Just to proceed forward.
Beautiful.
Different. Different response.
You know, it's possible that they were quite shook, but they didn't let it take them down. Like
yes.
You're saying.
Yeah, they moved forward.
They moved forward.
Mm-hmm.
So we can be quite shook, but we don't let it take us down. We get on that other bus that's moving the direction we want to go.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you for sharing that. Beautiful.
You're welcome.
Anyone else? Any ahas, oh-ohs, yippee? Oh no. Manisha.
Thank you so much, Acharya Sundri. It's just so profound. It's really hard to isolate any one thing. There's such life teachings about how to live a really quality, healthy life on every level. I'm reminded of how when I was asked to teach self-defense a lot in the 70s, actually in there in Santa Cruz, and I was like, well, for me, the self-defense, the defense is so emphasized, but if we knew about the self, we wouldn't need the defense because it's so reactionary. It's like this iambic phrase, self-defense. The focus is on the defense, but the self has all the answers. But I didn't really know what I meant by that until listening to these teachings from the Gita and Yogacharya Yu about what that means. So there is that. And it feels like I'm so overwhelmed by the beauty of everything that you have shared over the weeks, and especially today is so rich. But I got a very clear picture of having the power of the mind when it's not purified, how we can think, oh, I want to buy this kind of car. And then all of a sudden, the saying goes, we start seeing them everywhere. And how attractive the mind can become, and how vital it is to keep it purified so we can, or so I can observe what I'm thinking because how magnetic it is. And equally experiences that people say, oh, well, you can't do this, or you can't do this for this reason or that. And I just would never believe that and attracted such incredible experiences in my life because I don't subscribe to the external rules and perceptions. But I, like I said, I'm just overwhelmed by the blessing of these teachings. So thank you very much. I appreciate that you so much and the humor and the love and the light that you bring to it. And such clarity. Thank you.
Thank you, Manisha. You said many very inspiring things, and two, I want to highlight self-defense. Wow, I love that. We could make a nice bumper sticker or t-shirt, right? And put capital S, self, and then in parentheses, real small, defense. And what we're defending is our relationship with ourself,
Yes.
not from someone, but with our higher self. That's beautiful, and how wonderful you have the intuitive knowing so many years ago. And yes, and then magnetism. What we think is what our life becomes. And
Yes.
so this is the whole purpose of meditation and super conscious meditation. It is the promise of Kriya Yoga practices in the world and the deep meditation. I was going to say medication, the medication that is meditation. Is the promise. And I know you all know this, and I can tell you if you don't know from my own experience, it is 100% certain that with deep, repeated experiences of samadhi, and it's not like you become this enlightened person in a cave on a mountaintop and can't interact in the world. There are all types of samadhi, but deep, super conscious meditation seeds samskaras get burnt. They are gone. They go away. So maybe you had a tendency of being reactive and having anger just come up all the time. And that was an imprint in the mind, in the mental field. And there are all kinds of reasons that it gets triggered. I'm not seen, I'm not appreciated. It's about other people usually. I'm overused, whatever, whatever it is. That would get triggered, and boom, seeds like that can be burnt. they will go away. And those reactions will go with them. Guaranteed. And when you have that taste, when you have that experience, there is another layer, let's call it, of self-discipline that is required to continue. To not think, okay, I've had that experience. Now I understand I'm done. No, you've just started. We've just started. So that's what I think part of the beauty of our Sangha is, of this spiritual community. Because Manisha can share the things she just shared, and the rest of you are going, yes, I understand. I can relate. Or Sakshi can share what she experienced, reflect that to us, or Uma's words are mine, and we go, oh, yes, I know that. That's the beauty of being in community, right? We lift one another up, we support one another to take that next step to go even deeper. Wow, if that seed was burnt, what's it going to be like when that one's burnt? Cool. Let's go for it. So I appreciate you and your just your presence, who you are, and for being part of our Sangha. Om, have a blessed rest of your day.